going to continue with Ecclesiastes, and I would like to finish up tonight. What I'd like to take up, I don't believe I took up one of the lifestyles, I think, which is an important, the Torah deals with every lifestyle, and Ecclesiastes, when I say the Torah, I mean the Tanakh, in other words, the words of the prophets, and the Torah deal with every kind of lifestyle. And one of them, which is probably in our society certainly very prevalent, is the romantic one, and that is the person who lives for romantic love. But I don't mean a person that has a good marriage. That's a quiet kind of a enjoyment. I'm talking about fair and the passionate kind of love situation. Many times people are happily married, and especially what people call the middle-age crisis, people start searching around for the passionate love. And that is, for some people, that is the essence of their existence, to experience this kind of powerful pleasure and enjoyment. So I just wanted to mention that King Solomon has that there too, and that is in 726. Interesting to see how he expresses himself about that. He says over there, and I have found more bitter than death the woman. And over here, the woman. See, if when it says the woman could be one of two things. It could either be the instinctual drives, or else it could be Torah. And this is throughout the prophets. It's interesting why that is chosen. Sometimes the woman refers to Torah. Sometimes the woman refers to the instincts, the instinctual life, which is considered as wrong and as evil. And yet sometimes the word woman, and we'll get to that soon, refers to the best life, which is the Torah. And I'll explain why it is that way. It's based on a very deep psychological principle. But let's just assume that for a moment. Now here he's talking about the passionate kind of life. And by the way, when he says the woman, he means the passionate love. It doesn't matter whether it's from the man's side or the woman's side. He is speaking, of course, being a man from the man's side, but the same is true from the woman's side. Okay? So he says the passionate romantic life, he says, I found worse than death, and he says, because heart, meaning this is the case of the evil woman's heart, is captivating, and her hands are like buns. And he says, it is good before God that one should escape from her, and a sinner will be captured by her. Okay? So, of course, this is one verse, and, we have to just try to get to the nucleus of what King Solomon is trying to teach us here. Why does King Solomon say that the life of passionate love, and there are people, certainly in our society, we see it all the time, especially with the famous people that everybody watches, the Hollywood people, this is the very essence of their life. I mean, one romance after another, things get dull, time for another romance, time for another affair. This is their life. And as I said, Torah doesn't degrade lifestyles. It analyzes them and explains to you rationally what's wrong with them. Now, in this case, King Solomon is pointing to something here. And he's explaining why that kind of lifestyle cannot be a happy one. Okay? What is the reason? Well, the reason, obviously, is in his choice of words that is this kind of a lifestyle. And his choice of words, essentially, are captivating and bonds, can't escape. That's why he says a good person will escape from such a situation. What King Solomon is saying over here is that in the powerful grip of a passionate love relationship, the person has no freedom, and the person is in a situation where they are in bondage because they must act in a certain way, and in a certain way only, and that is in a way which will please the person that they are romantically attached to. So therefore, King Solomon says that such a life can never be happy because it's not a free life. He's captured. He's considered like a net, like an animal that's caught in a net. What he means to say is that any life that's not free with a person is completely under compulsion and restraint, and the person is forced to live a certain essential preoccupation is what the love object thinks of them. This certainly cannot be a good life, because it is, the person has no freedom. The good life must always be a free life. And in this respect, I mean, we would agree with Sigmund Freud's psychological analysis of the love situation, where he states that the state of being in love is really very similar to the state of neuroses. And neuroses is characterized by compulsion, and the same thing is true of the passionate love situation. So that is not a, neuroses is not a happy state of mind. Neurosis is a state where a person loses their freedom, their psychological freedom. So in this respect, King Solomon's analysis of the situation is really pretty close to Sigmund Freud's analysis of the love situation. Of course, as I mentioned before, this does not mean referring to a happy marriage. Happy marriage is always considered a good. This is referring to the person that is not satisfied with a happy marriage, the quiet happy marriage, but is looking at passionate, powerful emotional experience of love. Okay, I just thought I'd mention that because, as I said before, I mean, you know, the Torah does not look down, simply say things are prohibited. The Torah analyzes every kind of lifestyle and doesn't look down on anything and say this is not worthy of analysis. We have to, something, we just can't say it's prohibited. What's wrong with it? And if it's wrong, it has to be unhappy, and you have to understand why it is so. Okay, now what I would like to do is just to try to get, we have the problem is pretty clear. The problem is that there is no real lifestyle that a person can adopt in which he can be happy, for the simple reason that the moment you put your faith in any kind of a situation, your mind tells you immediately that things do not have to work out the way you wish them to, and therefore you're in conflict, and therefore you cannot be happy. So the question, of course, is there any lifestyle? And that's what King Solomon says, that he says everything is vanity. Vain means empty and simply not worthy of human striving. Oh, so that's the question he presents. Now, is there an answer? That's extremely important. In truth, there is an answer. There is no doubt, because King Solomon in Ecclesiastes does give advice. He does say, do this, do that. Now, obviously, when he's giving advice, then this is the answer. He's expecting you to realize that when he's saying that this is something which is good, he's recommending something, giving his recommendation, he's expecting you to realize that therein lies the answer. But, of course, as it is always in the Torah and the Prophet, it is, you know, you have to seek it out. It's not just given to you on a silver platter. So what I'd like to do tonight is to construct the answer that King Solomon has for the human dilemma of life. Now, let's just, there are a few aspects to it. What I'd like to do is, let me just give one more example of a deprecated lifestyle, a lifestyle that he shows is false. Again, it's important to have the false with the contrast, the true, and that's the whole style over here, and that's why it looks like contradictions, but it's not contradictions, it's opposing opinions or ideas. Now let's take a look for a moment at 8:10, okay? This is a difficult verse at first sight, where he says, and so I have seen wicked people that are buried, and they come forth. Okay, and then he says, and from a holy place they come, and it will be forgotten in the city that which they do. Okay, and this too, he says, is empty. All right, now let me explain to you, if you just literally translate the words, it doesn't make any sense. So, again, I'm going to resort to the benefit that we have of the scholars of Israel who had the true tradition of what the meaning of the verses are. This is the way they explain it. They explain it like this, that when it says that he saw wicked people buried and then they came forth, I don't know what your translation is, but I'm just giving you the literal translation. I have seen wicked people buried and they can't. What does this mean? Okay. What it means is that he's talking about life, and he's saying that people that are wicked during their lifetime, they're corrupt individuals, and we all often do with such individuals. They're corrupt individuals in our society. Many times they're great, known as great philanthropists, but you know, because they make a lot of money, oftentimes in a dishonest way, and those who are close to them know what they really are. But then when they have a lot of money, they make big donations, and people think, oh, these are great people. Okay. What he's saying here is a very similar thing. He's saying the wicked people that are buried, I saw them come forth, which means many times people live a wicked life. They can amass large sums of money, and then their children will come forth and will, you know, will buy a big plaque for them in the synagogue, or people will praise them. So what King Solomon is saying is that a lot of times people think, well, you know, maybe a person can get away with something during a lifetime, but, you know, truth will out. In other words, in the end, people are going to see that this person was false. Not so, says King Solomon. He says, don't even hope for that, because he says many times people are wicked and crooked, distorted, corrupt during their lifetimes, and yet their children, who are often, I'm just giving you an example, often people of means, they come forth, they set up these big memorials for these people, and these people go down in history as great people. So he says, don't even hope. A lot of times people think, well, you know, in the back of their mind, it pays to be virtuous because in the end people will know. King Solomon says, oh, no, no, if you're relying on that, you're making a mistake again. And that's the point of the whole Ecclesiastes, is to show how people fool themselves with these ideas during their lifetime. And when you analyze, that's true. So he says that there's two ways to interpret the rest of the verse, but they're both the way the rabbis interpret it or the way Ibn Ezra gives a more literal interpretation, but it's the same idea. The concept is that oftentimes the righteous person, the person that really is coming from a holy place, is forgotten. And he dies, perhaps he didn't have any children, and the good deeds that he does are simply forgotten forever. So what King Solomon is saying here again is he's disclosing another illusion, the illusions of man. The vain Solomon is talking about is all the illusions that man places before his mind's eye in order to get him through this life in a way that's satisfying, in a way that leads him, that gives him courage to live a good life. So King Solomon is not... doesn't want you to be fooled by that. He doesn't want you to do the good because of a false reason either. The Torah does not believe in the righteous lie. That was really a Gentile invention. But the Torah believes in the truth, and the Torah doesn't even want you to do the good if you have a false illusion about it. And he discloses the illusion. Many people are righteous because they think that in the end people are going to know the truth. So don't rely on that one. That doesn't work out either. That's just another illusion. And that's why King Solomon is disclosing that one over there. Okay, I just wanted to take one more example. I mean, there are many, as I said, there are many, many examples of the illusions that he breaks, you know, the illusions of man that he breaks throughout the book. I would recommend, if anybody wants to preserve the beautiful, beautiful topic, the best commentary is Rashi, because now that you have you should have by now an approach to the book. Once you have the approach to the book, then the details are not so difficult. So if you want to pursue this further, I would strongly suggest that you read through the book, but with the interpretation of Rashi, because Rashi brings the closest interpretation to the scholars, which have the true tradition of the correct interpretation of Kabbalah. So if you can choose one interpretation, I would choose Rashi. Ibn Ezra is great, of course. It's a little more philosophical, but I mean, as a first choice, Rashi is indispensable. Okay, as a beginning, you cannot do without Rashi. So at any rate, getting back to this, so that there is another case of an illusion. Now the question is, when all these illusions, most people righteous for reasons that are illusions. I mean, they comfort themselves during their lifetimes. They say, well, you know, I'm losing out, but it's better to be honest for this reason. It's better to be good. And that's basically what King Solomon shows, that all these reasons really fall apart when you analyze them. Okay. Now, let's get back to that I mentioned before. What is the good life? Is there really any kind of life that that man can live that makes him happy? I mean, that's a problem. So a person is a psychological being. He has to be happy. If he's not going to be happy, he can't function properly, okay? Let's take a look at an interesting verse here, which you have to you have to be very alert here and pick up on when he's when he's pointing to the answer. Okay, take a look at verse 8:1. Okay, he says, "Who is like the wise man, and who knows how to interpret a thing? The wisdom of a man lights up his face." And the strength of his countenance is different, okay? Now over here, you see the way he says that he's not making a statement. It's like a statement of awe, you know? Who is like the wise man? Who can give understanding and knowledge? What statement is he saying? Is good? Is bad? Before he said. You're a wise man. Doesn't matter. You're gonna die just like a fool. You're gonna die just like an animal. So that because you're wise, you're special and different and separate. That's just another illusion. He broke down that whole concept of the life of the great person. Okay, the great person really, if he thinks about the fact that he's gonna die like an animal, it kind of removes that whole idea of greatness. But here he says no. Here he says. He's in awe of the wise man. It is a statement of awe, an exclamatory statement. What does he mean by this? What he means to say is that there is a part of man who really does not care about rewards, is not concerned about benefit, is not concerned about gain, doesn't even think about the self, but is just awed. That awe really expresses itself among human beings in the greatest way when it comes to wisdom. That's what he's saying. He's saying, in other words, that the wisdom is one thing that a person cannot talk away. I was watching a show the other night where they had a biography of a famous film star, and they asked the person about his life. So they said, "Well, he's older now. He's really approaching death. I mean, he's pretty old." And he says, "Well, it was a wine, woman, and song. What more is there to say about it?" So when he was young and he had all these pleasures and these enjoyments, he was very enthralled by them, but now when he looks back at them, he says, he's an honest person. There's nothing much to talk about in my life. That's about it. But there's one thing. Pleasure could be talked away. Man, because man down deep recognizes that pleasure is a momentary kind of experience, or it has no real value. Like King Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, he says, and happiness, he says, what does it do for you? It does nothing, okay? So you had a moment of happiness. What happens the next day? You have nothing. But wisdom, he says, that is talk away. When an individual sees a wise person, he's awed, he's inspired. Who is like a wise man? It's an exclamatory statement. What he's trying to say is that here we see the soul of man, the essence of man, what the Torah calls the divine element in man, moved. It's being moved. It says, and you see, you see in Albert Einstein how respected he is even after his death. And now people recognize, this was a wise man. Here is intelligence. You can't talk that away. That's something you can't say, well, it's nothing. I mean, it's something which strikes a chord in the divine element of the human soul. So here King Solomon is moving towards an answer. What he's saying is, let's forget about why we do things for a moment. If you want to have the true life, you must look for the element in man that is awestruck by something truly great. And when the person is in that state of awe, he doesn't really care about anything. It's just, he doesn't even know why. Why do you recognize the great man, the great mind? Why? Not because he can produce any inventions. Not because he's a practical thinker. Not because of anything you can derive from him, but simply it's an awesome phenomena. Okay? Here we see man is drawn, not something great. So what King Solomon is saying now, he's putting together piecemeal, truly good life. And what he's saying over here is that the first thing we have to do if we look for the good life is we have to find something, which is intrinsically valuable, something which gives man, which draws him in an intrinsic way for no external reason. That's why it's a totally exclamatory statement. Who is like the wise man? And who knows how to interpret something? How beautiful it is when we see a wise person take a part of reality and interpret it and explain it and show us how it works. That's a beautiful experience. Then we look at that person and we say, wow, look how they're capable of understanding the in-depth ideas behind the superficial, meaningless, and unintelligible kind of phenomena. That is something which reaches deep down into the soul of man. And that's why he says the wisdom of a person lightens up his face. He looks different. His appearance is different. And I don't know if I can explain it, but I can only say that I have certainly experienced it. I studied under three of the greatest scholars of Israel, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Feinstein, and they're, I don't know. I probably you wouldn't say that they were handsome people in a classical sense, but that light in their face and their eyes was amazing. It was like you could just see it's a different kind of a countenance, different kind of a face, and the essence of the personality is lit up with the wisdom and the knowledge, and the flashing eyes and the look. I mean, it's a hard thing to describe, is something which is there because the personality is alive on a different level. It's not a physical beauty. You can see sometimes a person that has perfect features, classical sense of beauty, and there's a dullness. It's not alive. And then you can see a person who isn't real, but the inside the spark is evident, and the wisdom is something which actually causes the individual to the energy level to work in a totally different way, and one can see this from as an observer. That's what King Solomon is stating. You could see from the face that the inner life of this person is on a different energy wavelength. It's functioning differently, and the ideas are constantly. The mind is constantly moving, thinking of possibilities, ideas. That's where he says that and then he says, think of his countenance is different. Over here, by countenance, it means the part of the person that faces reality, and the way he acts is totally different. Most people act because they try to imitate certain models in their mind. They say, well, how would a person act in this situation? I'll act this way. They have certain models that they're imitating in different situations, calls to their mind certain individuals, or certain models of action which they try to imitate or to put themselves in a certain type of a gear, you know, for this type of situation. But that's not the wise man. The wise person is totally different. Everything is new, and everything is determined purely by reason. He doesn't follow any kind of modes of behavior. The modes of behavior that the world sets forth for various situations are meaningless to him. His countenance, he faces reality with only one thing, with wisdom and knowledge. And everything is fresh when he looks at it, and he just uses his reasoning ability and acts according to what his reason dictates in the given situation. It's a different kind of facing of reality. That's what it means by the strength of his countenance. The countenance means that part of man that faces reality, then encounters reality. So that's what King Solomon is saying in this verse. He's summing up the awesomeness of wisdom and the person who is the one who possesses this wisdom, the possessor of the wisdom. Okay, so here we get a clue as to what he would consider the correct life and the good life. That is, it has to be an attraction to wisdom, not because of the fact that if you are wise, you're going to be respected. It's not like the world has a respect for a great professor, you know, like mind, you know, this. Maybe sometimes people get drawn to that idea. Like people often say, well, when you're young, it's good to be an athlete. When you're older, It's good to be a philosopher, you know, those have images in their mind. But the image, of course, of greatness, he destroys, because he says death is the destruction of that. But the attraction to wisdom for its own sake, that one cannot deny. Wisdom cannot be, you can't talk away wisdom, and you cannot talk away a wise man. So they're reaching deep down into the personality. That is certainly a major ingredient, or the major ingredient in his answer. Okay, now we'll move on a little bit more, and that's with regard to appreciation of wisdom per se, which is the, as I said, a major component. But now let's take a look at another thing. You see, again, if you take a look at verse 5, he starts giving out the answer. He says, take a look at verse 5. He says, he who keeps the commandments, he says, does not anything evil. He says, of course, he says in another place that it won't help you, that the evil will befall you. It will befall you no matter what, because he says that... for instance, in 8:12, he says an evil person can live for a long time. Okay, but over here he says no. He says that a person that keeps the mitzvah will not know of any evil. He says, and a time and judgment the heart of the wise man knows. What he means is then in another justice just doesn't prevail. When we look around, we can't. You can't experimentally show justice. The answer is like this. The answer is, he is showing us that to do justice because of externals is not the life of illusion. But to understand justice, he says, justice is understood by the heart of the wise man. He means the wise man knows why the just life has to be the good life. Okay? He does it because logically he knows this is the good life. Let me explain that just through an example. What he means is that, let us say you were in a situation where you were in an uncivilized country and you're exposed to all kinds of diseases. Now, on the one hand, you'll say, if you have recourse to modern medicine, you'll say, well, certainly you're going to use that. But if you're going to think that modern medicine is going to save you, I could show you that it's not necessarily true, that in spite of your inoculations and in spite of all the precautions you take, people still do die in that situation. So if you're doing it because you think this is a foolproof method of self, that's false. But if you do it because logic dictates that this is the correct way, my analogy is not exact, I'm just using it as an analogy, but in your mind dictates that this is the correct thing to do, then you're being moved by something else. You're being moved by knowledge, because knowledge dictates that this is the healthy life.